This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we will talk with the Director of the Human Relations Commission for the City of Gary about a very important Unity Walk and Rally that's going to be held in downtown Gary this evening in showing the fight against racism and for tolerance. The conversation continues into that. We'll have that for you as well. And we'll also bring you our conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Big anniversary happening for Social Security, and we'll get some tips about that as well for planning your retirement future. And a conversation with Jim McClelland, who is considered Indiana's drug czar. He's going to be visiting Lake County next month. The Northwest Indiana community is invited to participate this evening in an event that is intended to show unity with a Virginia community that has become a visible part of the fight against racism and for tolerance. The Unity Walk and Rally will be held along Broadway in downtown Gary beginning about 7:15 p.m. Here's the Executive Director of the City of Gary's Human Relations Commission, Kanifa Khalil, to talk about it.
In light of the events that took place in Charlottesville about a couple weeks ago, August the 12th, we are holding the rally in Gary in solidarity with the events that took place in Charlottesville. And we're coming together. We're going to have a rally at the Human Relations Commission at 839 Broadway. And from there, we're going to walk down Broadway to City Hall, where we will have a vigil for the victims and those who were injured in Charlottesville.
I understand there'll be an opportunity to for folks who attend to participate in the vigil as well to hear some speakers who are scheduled to speak at the event right now.
Yes, we're inviting the entire community to come out, Northwest Indiana community to come out and join us. Mayor Karen has been scheduled to speak along with, we have Reverend Charles Streitelmeyer from the Northwest Indiana Federation of Interfaith Organizations. Mm-hmm. We also have Vanessa Allen from the Urban League. Stephen Mays participating from the Gary NAACP, and we also have a few other people who have been scheduled to speak as well. But those are the main ones.
Mm-hmm. My impression from the information I got from Mayor Freeman Wilson's office is there several hundred people might actually be out there. Of course, you'd like to have as many as you can without stopping traffic on Broadway, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. We plan to gather on the sidewalk, and so we should be out of the street. But yes, we do plan to be, you know, take up that space all along Broadway. Absolutely.
I know just recently Mayor Freeman Wilson was participating in a conference call that was sponsored by the organization, of which she is a very prominent member, that of the National Conference of Mayors. The Conference of Mayors had gotten together along with the Anti-Defamation League to go on record officially as being against the violence that happened at Charlottesville, as well as those who are protesting in as far as the anti the racist attacks, comments and views that were spewed at the rally itself in Virginia at the time. And I know that Mayor Freeman Wilson said that she had had prayers out for the families and other people that were involved and hurt, and particularly the one the family of the one person who actually died as a result of the rally that happened there in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has seemed to be in the days that have followed now seemed to be the attitude, certainly from City Hall, but from other people too, about how what has happened seems to have affected a way not only in Northwest Indiana but America feels about these matters.
Yes. Well, I believe, you know, all over the United States and particularly in northwestern, you know, Indiana, the region, we are feeling a great sadness. And, you know, this tragedy that happened in Charlottesville, it has spread all across the U.S. And We are all just very sad, but we are also hopeful. And the reason why we remain hopeful is because we know that we are a region of many races, many religions, many cultures, and we are confident in that we stand together in spite of these differences. We stand together against the hate and the bigotry, and we are on it. We are going to face these things head on, and we're going to face them together, and we're going to become stronger.
We're talking with Hanifa. Pardon me. Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Hanifa Khalik, who is the executive director of the City of Gary's Human Relations Commission. And we're talking about, of course, the incidents that happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the rally that turned to violence, unfortunately, and the protests that have happened as well there, and how there's going to be a walk and in turn a rally and a vigil to be held in the City of Gary outside Gary City Hall on Monday evening. I know the City of Gary has certainly being a welcoming city has been designated by Mayor Freeman Wilson and other city officials certainly shows that the community in Gary as well as the community at large in Northwest Indiana seems to be of a different mind of what happened as far as racial matters are concerned compared to some other places around the country. And do you think that because that we have had an early understanding with the way that our region is made up, that things are really different and you have to treat people differently?
I think that the region is going to have to speak for itself on that matter. And, you know, we can't sit around and wait on someone else to do something or someone else to create something. We have to create it ourselves. And so my response to that is going to be people just actively engaging themselves in the matter and not distancing themselves from this. And, you know, one thing I know is that, you know, we have reached out to everyone, like I said, from all different races, religions, backgrounds to be a part of this event, and they have responded well. And we are happy with that because we know that's what our region is about. You know, and so it's just going to have to be a stepping up to the plate and making this unity march happen and then continuing the unity after.
Now, after this unity rally coming up in the City of Gary, is a possibility there may be more scheduled after that?
Well, I'm not able to comment on that. I hope that there will be more coming together, more unity rallies coming together, but I'm not able to comment at this time on if there will be.
But you certainly hope that this is not the last one that's going to be held anytime soon, that the fight will continue, efforts to make sure that all Northwest Indiana residents and all Hoosiers, for that matter, are aware of the problems that have happened in other states and they can't happen in Indiana and they shouldn't happen in Indiana.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I hope that the unity rallies continue because we have to send a message to not only the people in this area, but like I said, across the country and in the U.S., that in spite of our differences, we are one and the same. We are human beings and we're on this earth and we've got to all get along. We have to all get along and we have to appreciate one another.
Once again, if you come on the conversation here, we want to let you know that the scheduled unity march that's going to happen on Monday evening is going to start out from the Gary Human Relations Commission offices, which is at 839 Broadway, about 7:15 in the evening. And then those involved will be walking up Broadway to City Hall at 401 Broadway. And that is where the vigil is going to be held, the front steps of City Hall. We've been talking with Hanifa Khalik, who is the executive director of the Human Relations Commission of the City of Gary, about the events coming up here on Monday. And we thank you very much for being with us, Hanifa. We hope that it certainly is going to be a success and have a number of people and, like I said, a good-sized rally show up to show their support and talk about the problems in the future ahead. We thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Since President Donald Trump took office, high-ranking federal officials have made numerous trips to Indiana, trips that are tightly scripted, and they're often closed to the public. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen has this report that explores why public officials aren't granting more public access.
Three top federal officials visited Indiana in August. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, and Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue.
The reality is that we all expect elected officials to bring home the bacon, so to speak.
That's political science professor Andy Downs. In Indiana's case, that elected official is Vice President Mike Pence.
And one of the things that can happen when you have someone like Vice President is you get high-level, high-ranking members of the administration to come to your state to talk about policy issues that are important to them.
And officials did talk about important policy issues. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue met with state officials and members of the Indiana Farm Bureau to discuss the 2018 Farm Bill, which includes the nation's food stamp policies. But the meeting was closed to the public. You needed an invitation to get in. And when reporters asked Perdue specifically what happened during the meeting, he responded with an off-her talking point.
I think, again, create a safety net where farmers can produce for the market and not produce for a program.
HUD Secretary Ben Carson also held closed-door meetings when he visited Indiana to meet with state officials and former residents of a lead-contaminated public housing complex in East Chicago. Like Perdue, Carson took questions from reporters after the meeting. When I asked a HUD spokesman why the meetings weren't open to the public or the media, the agency said that Carson had a, quote, very limited amount of time to spend in East Chicago, and Secretary Carson was genuinely interested in hearing from the residents of the West Calumet housing complex. Political science professor Andy Downs says that approach has become more common and can make certain sense when officials are discussing very specific issues, like the one in East Chicago.
Because now we're seeing a number of people decide to get rather upset and exercised at public meetings, it makes having public meetings a little more dangerous or a little less controlled.
But while Perdue and Carson held reporter Q&As during their visits to Indiana, the same cannot be said for EPA Chief Scott Pruitt. During a visit to East Chicago in April, Pruitt ignored reporters after a 90-second statement.
Thank you for the time, and Governor, again, thank you for bringing this team together. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Safe travel.
Administrator Pruitt, we take some questions?
Pruitt visited Indiana again this August and, again, held meetings close to the public, although this time he didn't give a public statement or even notify the press he was coming. So I asked the EPA a few questions, including what Pruitt did during his visit and why the meetings were closed to the public. EPA spokesman Jahan Wilcox said in an emailed statement that Pruitt toured a coal mine, met with state officials and a small group of farmers to discuss the proposed clean water rule, and talked to a conservative talk show host in Indianapolis. I pointed out to Wilcox that he only answered one of my questions, but received the same statement in return. Some Hoosiers, such as Thomas Frank, say public policy matters shouldn't be discussed solely behind closed doors. Frank is an environmental activist who lives in East Chicago's lead-contaminated Superfund site.
And we're really kind of concerned, or very concerned, about the privatization of those conversations.
Frank says the health and welfare of his community, at least, would be better served if public officials spent more time with the public. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
Well, it's hard to believe that Social Security is 82 years old this year, but it is the month of August, and of course it's a major part of many people's retirement plans, their lives, their livelihoods for some people. And while the government is telling us about problems with Social Security, it's still something to mark, and there's still a way you can take advantage of this and building it into your retirement plan. And of course that means we're turning to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer to tell us more about it. Greg, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us here first about the importance of Social Security for Hoosiers, at least.
It does represent a very large portion of retirement income for those folks in retirement. And in Indiana alone, the population of 65 and over, those receiving Social Security, is near 900,000 individuals. And Social Security lifts about 350,000 of those from an income level out of poverty.
When you deal with a lot of these things and dealing, of course, with the importance of Social Security as a major source of income for the elderly, you have to take into account a lot of strategies as well, too, to be able to make sure that if you do receive Social Security payments, that you in turn use the money wisely and can leverage it, I guess, against whatever investment that you have here. Tell us first here about how you can maximize your benefits if you do things right.
Yeah, there's a couple of different things to consider. One is just understanding that if you do take it early, you're reducing the benefit that you earned. That's one of the things I always encourage folks to understand. If you take it earlier than your full retirement age, let's say 62, you're only going to get 75% of the benefits that you earned through the Social Security system. Also, when you consider spousal benefits, potential widow benefits, divorce benefits, there's a lot of different things to consider for everybody's individual situation. But assuming that you know, they continue with their normal expected inflation rate, choosing to collect early could cost thousands of dollars in benefits.
We didn't usually don't always mention about the fact that the survivors, widows, survivors, family members, and the like that are, can be qualified because of the maybe disabled or whatever it may be. They get to take advantage of the Social Security benefits as well too, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of exceptions to the rules, especially around the widows. And then also how you choose to elect those benefits in those situations, you have to consider the tax impact, because the taxes, whether your Social Security becomes reportable, is determined by all the other things that you're doing strategy-wise in terms of creating income from your other investments or other income sources.
Yeah. I know one of the other strategies that you talk about often with your clients is what you refer to as turning back the clock. Tell us what you mean by that and how that fits into this, especially with Social Security benefits.
Yeah, so a lot of times once people start collecting Social Security early on, they might realize, hey, maybe it wasn't the best idea to start collecting early. The money's not, you know, playing out the way I thought it would in retirement. My income's not, you know, where I think I need to be, especially if they're thinking about considering going back to work. If it's in the first 12 months, you can actually withdraw your application. You do have to pay it back, but you can withdraw your application as if you never took it. It's a one-time rule, and then you can kind of reset the clock on those benefits and get the increasing benefits, and then look to organize a strategy that would make a little bit more sense for the situation.
I guess that's where you talk about the possibility that you can kind of revisit this at some time in the future, and the longer you wait, the longer you can hold out, not having to use your Social Security benefits. It does help out, too, in the long run, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of times people don't realize how much they're giving up and realize that a lot of the incidental expenses, you know, are still there. They think they're going to be able to trim the budget. They can't. And, yeah, they just need to rethink what their original process was going into it. And for those that are beyond that year, you can stop payments, but you have to wait until your full retirement age, which for most people is going to be around 66. But, again, you could stop it at that point and then look to increase your benefit at a rate of 8% per year after that until age 70.
That's great. How do spouses fit into all of this? We talk about survivors and widows and the like, but we don't always talk as much about spouses. They, of course, will be able to earn some Social Security benefits as part of what you may happen to have. And how do you work all those things out?
Yeah, so the spouses are what really a lot of the planning and the different options, you know, begin to multiply, become a little bit more complex, because a lot of people will evaluate their Social Security based on break-even points with whole numbers, which we already talked about. You have to consider net dollars. You know, it's always about what's coming in, not what the gross check looks like. But when it comes to the spouses, one of the things I always have to consider and tell my clients they have to heavily consider is when collecting those benefits, there's a very good chance if both spouses have reached retirement, that one of those spouses is going to live well into their 80s, given the current life expectancies. And so a lot of people say, well, we'll break even points at 75 or 78. I'm not going to wait that long.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of times when you're having a spouse and coordinating those benefits, you really need to consider potentially at least one of those being delayed, because that benefit ultimately ends up with the survivor, which means it's probably going to be well into 20, 25 years.
I know you also talked, too, about making sure, and we kind of alluded to this earlier in our conversation, about the fact that Social Security is really should be designed to be part of a whole comprehensive plan for your retirement. Tell us where that fits in.
Right. So when we talk to folks about collecting Social Security, distribution stage of money is a little bit different than accumulation. How your taxes are impacted are directly determined by some controllable events that you do in your retirement or you set up in your retirement. What I mean by that, Chris, real simply is, you know, when we have wages, it's 100% taxable. We're never going to tell somebody to pay us less. But how you choose to collect your income in retirement, how you choose to have those assets positioned, be it traditional type IRAs versus Roth IRAs, collecting money from pensions or not having pensions, from taxable accounts, non-taxable accounts. There's a thing called provisional income in the Social Security world. And the very simple version of what I'm trying to explain is how things show up on your tax return directly determine how much of your Social Security you're going to have to report as income and ultimately pay taxes on. And then also, once you start that Social Security, it's going to change the tax impact of your withdrawals from your qualified plans. So you literally could be talking about thousands of dollars in taxes, just depending on how you are setting up your income stream and just having enough understanding of how all those things intertwine and the cause and effect of all the things that you do moving into retirement. And it's new for everybody. So, you know, it's easy to make mistakes. You've never had Social Security, never had to claim it. You know, you've never had to start distributions for most folks. And all that newness, so to speak, creates, you know, potential mistakes that, you know, could cost that consumer a lot of money and tax implications that they may have easily been able to avoid.
Well, finally, Greg, how secure is Social Security these days? We hear a lot of stories and see a lot of things in the media about this. A lot of people are very, very concerned about the fact that Social Security is going to go bankrupt soon. Well, it's not quite soon.
Yeah. Well, and the one thing just to clarify, because the big knowledge out there, the exposure that it is the trust fund. And the trust fund is expected to run out of money sometime around the 2034. But the trust fund is actually the surplus that was created over the last several years. Social Security is what they call a pay-as-you-go system, which basically means it was never designed to have an account to pay for benefits. It was always designed for the people working to pay for those receiving benefits. And when it was originally designed in 1935, nobody anticipated life expectancy to go from late 60s to mid-80s. And so under the current program, without reform, which I anticipate that they'll continue to reform, we're seeing it already, it will be about 77 cents on the dollar when the trust fund is exhausted. So the current workforce would be able to support about 77% of the benefits. But they're making changes. As you know, what used to be 65 is now 66 or 67 for a lot of folks. And they'll continue to increase the amount of Social Security taxes that are going to be paid, and I'm hard-pressed to believe that they won't continue to, you know, reform that program because it does represent such a substantial part of a lot of folks' income.
Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, as always, thanks for being with us, and thanks for the advice.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
On September 7th here in Northwest Indiana, the executive director for Indiana's drug prevention, treatment, and enforcement efforts will be visiting the region to talk to a group about the topic of substance abuse. In fact, he's going to appear before the Lake County Substance Abuse Council meeting on September 7th. We have Jim McClellan with us to give us an idea of what he's going to be bringing up when he makes his trip up from Indianapolis. Jim, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
It's my pleasure, Chris.
Well, for people who are not familiar with we've written your title, but what do you do, and how does it fit in with your visit coming up here? It's a big title for a big responsibility that Governor Eric Holcomb has put on your shoulders, I know.
Well, Governor Holcomb has made attacking this drug epidemic one of his very top priorities. When I was asked to take on this role, and this goes back to last December, he said that everywhere he went on the campaign trail last year, someone would come up to him and tell him a personal story about how they or someone close to them had been affected by this, particularly this opioid epidemic. And he just decided he was going to make it a very top priority. So the day he was inaugurated, he signed an executive order creating this position with this long title that a lot of people are shortening to drug czar. And basically, my role is to coordinate, align, focus the relevant resources of nine different state agencies that touch this issue in one way or another, and then to try to leverage the resources the state has with those from other sectors, business, higher education, healthcare sector, philanthropies, faith-based communities, and try to bring pieces together in a coherent way that'll enable us to have the greatest possible impact on this epidemic, given the resources that are available to us.
You talk about 9 agencies that this problem tends to cover in some way or the other, it affects some way or the other. Obviously, people think of the Indiana State Department of Health, and they think probably also about the Indiana State Police. But what are these other agencies in Indiana government that have to deal one way or the other with the opioid problems in general?
A very big one is the Family and Social Services Administration, which has within it the Division of Mental Health and Addictions. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of treatment is done through that division. Treatment funding flows through that division. But in addition, DCS, Division of Child Services, my gosh, the impact of this thing on children is just phenomenal. It's awful. The percentage of children removed from their homes by DCS because of parental substance abuse went up 22% from 2015 to 2016. Those kinds of situations now account for over for 53% of all removals by DCS. So that's another one. The Professional Licensing Agency has a role in this. The Department of Insurance has a role in this. There are so many pieces to this. It's a very, very complex issue. And because it's so complex, there are no quick or easy solutions.
I was going to say that probably explains in large part why the problem is recognized, but it's hard to combat it.
That's exactly right. And early on, as we got into this, we were looking at all these various pieces to it, and we said we have to have a strategic approach to this, or we're just going to end up playing whack-a-mole. And, you know, you throw a little bit over here at this piece and then you throw a little money over at another piece. And all of these might be individually worthy, but they might not be the highest priorities. And they might not have enough cumulative impact and be connected with each other well enough that you're going to get the kind of results that you're really looking for. And this is a big problem. You know, there are more people dying of overdoses in this country now than from vehicle accidents and gun homicides combined. It's just phenomenal, and it keeps going up, and it's something that you know, we have to attack on multiple fronts at the same time. It's not something where you can do this sequentially, do this and then do that. You've got to be hitting on multiple. In multiple areas simultaneously, and so that becomes something that requires an awful lot of coordination and a lot of cooperation. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that because the governor's made it such a high priority, there's just great cooperation among the various state agencies who are working together to get a handle on this.
We're talking about Jim McClelland, who is been named by Governor Holcomb as the Executive Director for Drug Prevention, Treatment, and Enforcement across the Hoosier State, coordinating all the efforts that have some impact by the opioid crisis and other related issues with substance abuse. He's going to be speaking at the September 7th Lake County Substance Abuse Council meeting. And Jim, if you will, tell us a little about obviously you're going to give an update, talk about how things are shaping up around the Hoosier State. What in particular are you hoping to take to the folks here in Lake County who are going to be listening to you talk?
Well, I will be giving them an update of what the state's doing, and there is quite a bit of action. Some of it's behind the scenes, efforts to bring data together across various silos and convert that into more useful, timely, actionable information that can help us deploy resources more effectively. But then we also are adding opioid treatment programs in 5 different locations around the state. We have some RFPs out right now for projects that are going to be funded with money that we receive from a grant made possible by the 21st Century Cures Act that Congress passed last year. And I'll be giving an update on these sorts of things. We also have we've submitted a waiver request to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid in D.C. And if we get that, and we do expect to get it, it would make available quite a lot more money in Indiana for treatment and recovery supports. So I'll be giving an update on that. And one of the messages that I like to take when I'm traveling around the state is, you know, there are certain areas where the state can and must lead, and yet so much of the work that needs to be done, particularly when you're talking about prevention, and when you're talking about support of people who are recovering from a substance use disorder, that has to be done at a local level.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd love to see and to encourage collaborations of people from different aspects of a community coming together and tackling this thing to help their fellow citizens.
We had a chance here just recently to talk with a doctor who is in private practice in Crown Point, but he is also the medical director for the Recovery Works treatment and rehabilitation facility that's just been set up here in Merrillville. And he recently picked up an honor from, of all people, the Lake County Council. They've recognized him in advance of the impending International Overdose Awareness Day coming up here in the next few days ahead. And obviously, there are a lot of organizations that are not only nonprofit, but even a commercial, so to speak, for-profit operations, trying to help people as well. And it's probably great to have them in the fold, helping with.
Well, it is. This is something where we really need all hands on deck. If you look at some of the data, and you look at substance abuse issues. Overall, not just opioid issues, but also other substance abuse problems. You know, there are over 20 million people in this country who have some sort of substance use disorder. Only about a tenth of them are getting treatment, and of those, some of the data that I've seen indicates that probably only about a third are getting evidence-based treatment. And so we've got to do a lot more to educate people, to inform them, to make them aware of some of the risks, to reduce stigma. There's still an enormous amount of stigma as people often don't understand that there are many paths to addiction, and with an opioid addiction. Once you've got it, you've got a chronic disease. It's mm-hmm. changed the structure of your brain, but it's treatable. But while it's treatable, few people are going to be able to overcome it without treatment. And compared with other addictive substances such as cocaine and meth, treatment for an opioid use disorder typically takes longer, and the risk of relapse is higher. So more supports are needed. You know, there's I read something recently that there was a sentence that just jumped out at me, and it's one that we have to work on. And it's sad but true that it's a lot easier to get high than it is to get help.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to make it easier for people to get help when they need it, when they are ready for it, and where they are.
Jim McClellan is the Executive Director for Drug Prevention, Treatment, and Enforcement with the State of Indiana. He's been appointed to that position by Governor Eric Holcomb. Jim, thank you for being with us, and I hope you enjoy your stay and your comments that you get to make to the Lake County Substance Abuse Council meeting coming up on September 7th. Thank you for talking about it today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
We have another look into the opioid addiction crisis coming up. Thousands of people are overdosing on opioids every year across the country. Many of these people end up in emergency rooms, and in a lot of cases, that's where treatment ends. But a hospital in Indianapolis is connecting people to addiction treatment through the ER. Cytomex Public Media's Jake Harper spoke with one man who says the program has helped him get into recovery.
The walk's pretty far, man. You up for it?
It's Saturday, and Christopher Hines is taking me on a walk. We cross a bridge over a highway on a street without sidewalks. He's leading me to the place he overdosed earlier this year. It wasn't his first.
No, I overdosed, I want to say four times. I think it was five in a three-month period.
But he hopes it was his last. That morning, Hines woke up early, sick from withdrawals. So he set out to buy some heroin. He says there was snow on the ground. His hands were numb, his feet were soaked, but he didn't care.
You don't think about nothing but getting it when you're sick like that.
Hines has taken walks like this for years. He's 41 now and says his addiction started in his teens when his buddy got shot.
And I was helping take care of him. Well, he pitched me a few pills here and there, and before you know it, he was getting his script just to give them to me to take care of him.
When pills got hard to find, Hines says he tried heroin and liked it. As he continued using, keeping a job became harder, and he was arrested multiple times.
But prison never deterred me. You'd think, man, that, you know, go to prison once. People think it's a moral decision to use drugs, that you're just doing bad decision-making and that it's a moral decision. But that's not what it is, man. Once you get hooked on drugs and you're using, it stops becoming a decision. It's almost the same as wanting to eat, drink, sleep.
It was that need that pushed him to stop here.
You can see from here, man, this is the Subway.
At a Subway restaurant 2.5 miles from his home. After he bought his drugs, he couldn't wait anymore.
And was like, I'm done, man. I'm going in here and getting high.
He used in the bathroom, and when he came back out, he didn't make it far.
I'd seen that dead end sign, and I remember vaguely it getting kind of blurry. And then this next yard here, I remember making it to that yard, and I stood there, and I don't remember anything after that. So I imagine that's where I, you know, fell out.
He had overdosed again, but this time something different happened. After he woke up, he met a doctor, Krista Brucker, at Eskenazi Hospital. Brucker and her team had identified a problem in the ER. Usually, patients are revived with naloxone, the opioid overdose antidote, and brought to the hospital.
But once they're sort of stabilized and awake and talking, really not a lot was happening. We're getting, at best, sort of a pamphlet or a handout about where they could maybe try and get help, and then being sent on their way.
But Brucker wanted to do more, to connect people directly to treatment, or at least talk to them about using clean needles, using naloxone, getting tested for hepatitis C. That idea became Project Point.
One thing that we heard a lot of before we started the program was like, they're not going to want to talk to you. They're just going to want to go out and get high again. We found that to be almost universally not true.
The program got more funding from the Fairbanks Foundation to expand its services. Full disclosure, that foundation also gives money to my employer. Since January, Project Point has been able to see more than 180 patients. The theory is when people overdose, it's a wake-up call that might push them to get help. And that was true for Christopher Hines. He had tried to get help before with no luck. He was tired of using opioids, of hurting his family.
Every time the same thing pops in my head, and it's my son. Every time. And then after I sit there for a few minutes and I start realizing, oh, I'd overdosed again. I'm back in the hospital. This is time number, you know, upteenth time in my life that I've been in the hospital for overdose. The next thing on my mind is getting help.
And he got it. He's in counseling and on a medication to help with his addiction. He's relapsed a couple times, a normal part of treatment, but he says it's going well.
I've had happy moments, you know, genuine happy moments. I've had to fake them, laugh when people tell jokes, but I didn't have any emotions. It's crazy. Watching Chicago Med, somebody dies and I'm crying. It's crazy, man. But it was a good cry, you know, it felt good.
Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Welcome to Season 2 of Quantum Leap Soundbites. We're back this week with another story of Hoosier ingenuity. This week, we're headed to an unusual place in Indiana that inspired scientific, artistic, and technological innovation in the late 1800s. This place is a dark, damp, and smelly swamp. And not just any swamp, the Limberlost Swamp in northeastern Indiana, which was the laboratory and inspiration for the famous Gene Stratton Porter's life work. It's weird to think of a swamp as something special to someone. We usually think of swamps as dirty and gross, you know, places to avoid. But in fact, wetlands are natural and important ecosystems, home to a large variety of animals and insects. And before settlers arrived, we had 5.6 million acres of wetlands in Indiana. But settlers came and drained the wetlands to farm on, to log, to build roads and cities, and 4.7 million acres of wetlands were lost. In total, Indiana lost 95% of our wetlands from the mid-19th to early 20th centuries, more than almost every other state. So picture Jean Stratton Porter, relocating to Geneva, Indiana with her husband when she's in her 30s. She traveled out to the Limberlost Swamp near her home, a swamp that was being drained at the time. This swamp, with its huge variety of birds and fauna, became an inspiration to her at the time it was being destroyed. Jane didn't just observe the birds in the swamp. She used a new technology, a camera, to capture images of these birds. According to Nicole Ball, staff at the Limberlost State Historic Site, these photographs were innovative.
Usually people were photographing dead birds, birds that were mounted, because they couldn't get close enough to get these shots of live birds. And Jean would go out there with her cameras and kind of camouflage them and wait and wait and wait until she got, you know, the perfect shot.
After birds, she became obsessed with moths. Jean brought moths into her home and studied the life process from birth to death of several generations of moths. Through her close study, she was able to disprove incorrect theories about moths in her book, Moths of the Limberlost. She disproved the idea that moths have color vision and logged in great detail how moths utilize powerful scents to attract mates. But maybe more importantly, through her intimate knowledge of the life of moths, she was able to photograph them when they're at their most beautiful. She is believed to be the first person to photograph moths as they first emerge from the cocoon, when they are their most colorful, instead of how people usually illustrate them. What Jean called the illustrations of colorless, practically dead moths. She then colored in her black and white photographs to give the most vibrant portrayal of moths that had ever been created up to that point. Yet while Jean was expanding the world's knowledge of nature and ecology, the Limberlost swamp was being destroyed and drained. To make the land suitable for farming, draining tiles had been installed beneath the swamp, redirecting water to the nearby Wabash River. According to Nicole Ball, Jean didn't have much power to stop them, and probably felt helpless watching people drain the swamp she drew so much inspiration from. Remember, this was all happening before women even had the right to vote. Without the inspiration of the Limberlost swamp, Jean moved away. As she became a famous author and photographer, she eventually gained the courage to try to save other swamps in Indiana from being destroyed. The Indiana legislature was planning to drain the swamp in Noble County when Jean, now a best-selling author, visited the General Assembly to speak against the proposed plans. She told the General Assembly stories of her experience of Limberlost, and they decided to temporarily refrain from destroying the swamp. Jean spent her life doing her best to conserve the diversity of wildlife she saw in Indiana. She transplanted plants into her garden that she saw disappearing from Indiana wildlife to repopulate species, like pitcher plants and fringed gentians. And she used the money she earned as an acclaimed author to continue her passion for observing and preserving nature. Inspired by an Indiana swamp, Jean wrote best-selling novels, became a self-taught scientist, an innovative photographer, and eventually one of the first women to open her own production company in Hollywood. She is one of the most remarkable examples of ingenious Hoosiers who pushed forward science, driven by curiosity and passion, making a difference not only in Indiana, but also adding to the world's knowledge, making today's story the perfect kickoff to season 2 of Quantum Leap Soundbites. And hey, it was also Jean Stratton Porter's birthday recently, on August 17th. So join me in wishing Jean a very happy belated birthday, and join us next time for more stories of Hoosier STEM innovation. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
Well, it's Monday, and that means it's time for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is John Kane. John, wait, shouldn't this be flipped? This should be around, right?
You said joining me. Do they know who you are?
I hope so. I'm Tom Maloney and Donna Catalano. Donna, welcome to the studio as well.
Thank you, Tom.
And now you're both in here to talk about what's coming up. Well, all the way up on September 10th, it's the South Shore Arts presentation of Sunday Afternoon in the Artful Garden.
Yes, you're making it sound like it's a play or something. It's
sort of like a Shakespeare thing,
yeah, maybe,
but really not.
So this is going to be a classy afternoon event, outdoor event, outdoor. We hope.
Well, we do have some covered areas, so don't be afraid to buy a ticket in case you think it might rain, because rain will be okay.
So we're calling it Sunday Afternoon in the Artful Garden because South Shore Arts has operated a branch location in Crown Point for 19 years.
It's been 19 years?
19
yeah,
years.
Yeah, it feels like a lifetime. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. most of your lifetime.
That's right, most of mine.
It's been my whole lifetime with South Shore Arts.
Yes.
So we were first located at the old bank at the corner of Joliet and Main Street. Then we moved to, I don't even remember our address anymore, but on North Main Street.
123 North Main.
Thank you.
Across from the library.
Mm-hmm. Across from the library, which was still under construction at the mm-hmm. time that we mm-hmm. moved in, and that was about six or so years ago, mm-hmm. six, seven, whatever it was. And this last year, we relocated to the original Artful Garden on Indiana Avenue, 611 North Indiana Avenue, where Liz Messing operated a year-round store, a business where she sold really fantastic garden items and heavy concrete mm-hmm. statuary.
I was going to say, it's right there just off of Summit, right, where all of the industrial right. sort of area yeah. is in Crown Point.
And
right.
she also sold very artsy home decor.
Right, mm-hmm. inside the little house that was on the property.
I lived right down the road from that, and every time I would drive by, I would look over, and I always admired. I saw that South Shore Arts sign, yeah. obviously, but I admired the front yard because it's like,
mine
like
should
to
look
have
like that.
That.
Yeah.
Like
yeah
to have
it's
that.
So pretty. So a couple of years ago, Liz decided not to be in the heavy concrete hauling business so much anymore. And she relocated to the square. She did just the opposite of what we've done. She went to the square. She's across from the old courthouse. And she has a really great thriving business there of women's boutique kind of items and household items. And
absolutely.
Anyway, enough about Liz. Yeah. So she had the old Artful Garden property available and was wondering what to do with it when we kind of got the idea that that would be a great location.
Yeah,
for
it was
us.
Another drive-by idea.
Yeah, there we go.
Really. Mm-hmm. And so we moved in March of this year, and where we do art classes there. Mm-hmm. We sell South Shore posters there, and we have art exhibits mm-hmm. there. So it's all the same things we've been doing over the years, but in a new location. And also a location that gives us the opportunity to do things outdoors and have art workshops outside and painting in plein air, en plein air. And so this Sunday afternoon in the Artful Garden is a fundraiser to help us continue to operate at that location and going forward. We have a challenge grant from a generous donor of $25,000 that we are going to be raising money for now to get that money mm-hmm. match so mm-hmm. that we can get so our goal is $50,000. It's a modest goal, but it's one that will really help us continue to operate in Crown Point. And we've been doing well at the Artful Garden, and we have a great committee mm-hmm. of Crown Point, primarily Crown Point residents, who are helping us organize this event that will be on Sunday afternoon, September the 10th, from 2 to 5. It's $100 per person until when, and then the price goes up to $125.
I think about a week before it goes up a little bit, and yeah. then but it's going to have music and vendors,
jazz, and wine, beer, appetizers.
Jeff Brown's Jazz Trio,
oh, very
which is,
nice.
Everybody enjoys. Mm-hmm. He mm-hmm. organizes the jazz festival at Valparaiso University, so yep. he's very well.
And I will say it does come with a caveat, though. It's limited to 200 people.
Yes.
So you've got to get your tickets now before yes. it sells out.
And buy mm-hmm. them now so that you don't have to pay the $25 extra.
There we go. That
yeah,
works.
It's really cool. But really cool artists are being selected for who are going to have booths and great wines and great beers mm-hmm. and great food.
Yeah. Crown Brewery is going to do the wines and the beers. So
yeah.
we'll have some seasonal ales that will be there for everyone. So
very festive.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly.
So we're looking forward to a beautiful day. You can get tickets on the South Shore Arts website, southshoreartsonline.org.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me on this edition of Eye on the Arts. Tune in next Monday with, of course, host John Kane for another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Thank you for having us.
And you can hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we'll find out more about this year's Pathways to Purpose speaker series at Valparaiso University.